Hi everyone. We are continuing our conversations for Education Impact Day 2016, and we are really excited to, I believe I said it, let's see, is hour 10, no, hour 11. This would be hour 11. If you're 11, then there's one more guest. So we're hour 11 hanging in there. And Jared Stein from Instructure Canvas. And do you consider yourself Canvas or Instructure, or how do you, what do you call yourself?
Yeah, so the company's name is Instructure, and Canvas is the flagship product, the learning management system.
So, in my interactions with Jared, we use Canvas Network as part of our OpenAB MOOC. And so we've had some interactions with that, and then working with Hillary, which is our contact from the instructional design side. So we've had a great relationship with Canvas, and thank you guys so much for doing what you do, the openness that you allow us, as well as other nonprofits and other universities, to use your platform. So,
I'm glad we're able to.
yeah, so why don't you give us a little overview of what you do at Canvas?
Sure. So I've been with Instructure for just over 5 years. Like last week was my 5 year anniversary. So it feels like a few weeks though. There's so much to do and so much to work on and so many different people to talk to. But in my current role, I head up our product strategy for higher education. And so really what that means is I talk with a lot of people, I read a lot of things, and I try to have that all coalesce into the vision, which becomes the roadmap for the development of the products and the services. And that's what we do as a business. I have kind of this great job where I look at a lot of research, I talk with a lot of practitioners, and I try to bring it all together.
So we talked this morning. We had Lisa Petrides from OER Commons on, and one of the things, the themes that we asked her some questions around were this idea of educational entrepreneurship. And I think those of us that started watching Canvas just as a little seed of an idea, and then to see how it's taken off. So can you give those of us that might not be as familiar, it's been a relatively rapid explosion, and in a space that was pretty, it had a lot of pretty well-known and established players. So can you kind of take us
Yeah.
through some of that, that aspect of it?
Sure. Yeah, and maybe one way to lead into that is talk a little bit about how I came to know about Canvas. So before joining the company, I worked in higher ed for about 12 years, primarily helping grow online and blended programs, and did a lot of faculty development, led a team of instructional designers, and so on and so forth. And of course, part of that was the LMS, for good or for ill. And I remember it was now about 8 years ago when the founders of Instructure came and visited us at Utah Valley University and said, "Hey, we hear you guys aren't too happy with your LMS, and we have some ideas." And they presented their ideas, and we said, "Hey, those are really, really great ideas. You're never going to make it."
Yeah.
We said, "Why? There's this behemoth in the market, and they've bought up all the competition, and now they're suing the only competition left. So good luck, guys." And then on top of that, there's just kind of the technical challenge of building a system that tries to meet the needs of so many different educators, right? So many different disciplines, so many different teaching approaches. So it was really a Herculean challenge for these two grad students, they're students still at the time, to try to undertake. But they're super persistent, and they kept talking and having dialogue with folks like myself around the country, and they didn't, kind of jump in and start building software. They just kind of engaged in this product validation tour that they call it, where they presented ideas and they had discussions and they revised those ideas. And when they felt like they had a clear sense of what they could do differently, that's when they started writing code. And I remember they came to me. I think it was early December or November or something, near the end of a semester. And they said, "Hey, we've been having these conversations. Our software is almost ready to be used. You teach some online courses. So would you be willing to teach at least one of those courses on Canvas if we get it done?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. If you ever get it done, I'll teach a course." So they came back a couple weeks later and they said, "Hey, it's ready." And so I taught on it, and it was, you know, it was pretty primitive at the time. But I saw some things in there that, to me, were kind of magical. And the main thing was just the ease of use of the system. It was just a lot easier to use. It was pretty intuitive. I didn't have to look things up and learn. But the other thing was that I could tell it was built with openness at its heart. And that's both from a technical aspect, as well as from a sense of, you know, being connected to the open web and preparing to embrace open educational resources and similar type things. So that's a little bit of the history. Right before it launched as a commercial product, they decided to open source the code, which was kind of their way of saying, hey world, you know, even if another company were to acquire us, don't worry, the code is open source. The only thing they'd be buying would be the people. Right. And that was sort of a way to inoculate themselves from the threat of acquisition. But it was also kind of a strong stance in terms of their core value of openness. So that's how it started. One of the earliest customers was the Utah Education Network. Utah Valley University was a part of that. And we've just kind of grown really steadily since then.
I just remember, and maybe I am really dating myself, because to me, 8 years, I would not have guessed. I mean, I guess that really wasn't. And I was part of, they certainly didn't come and interview me personally, but I was certainly around people who were being talked, much like you. You're like, you should see these guys that they've got this idea, and they think they're going to take on Blackboard and whoever and actually beat them. Are you kidding? And one of the first examples I had was the idea, and I think they were using this as an example, rather than building like Blackboard has like a, and I shouldn't probably name names, it might get you in trouble, but the competitors were trying to build everything in-house, so a wiki, you know, to replicate like Google Docs, rather than finding a way to pull in those, why recreate the wheel? And I'm kind of curious if that's maybe why they were able to turn around for you, because rather than building their own wiki or collaborative document, that was seemed to be their model for production, was figuring out how to pull in these loosely joined pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, the technical task of building a learning management system is huge. And so how do you get into this market where there are incumbents who've been around forever, building onto their code base forever and ever? And so their approach was one to say, okay, everything in the design of this should be as simple as possible, and we need to think things through so there's not four different ways to create content. But two, we don't have to be everything to everybody. In fact, that's a mistake. What we can do is integrate best-of-breed tools into the system, but also create some technical avenues so that people can do that on their own as well without our permission. And that also gets to the heart of openness from a platform perspective. So I think, that was a big advantage. For me as a practitioner, as somebody who taught, my students were using blogs, like real blogs, not something called a blog inside of an LMS. Mm-hmm. And they recognized that and appreciated that. And for folks like me, they said, you know what though? You're still going to find value in Canvas because you still need to provide feedback and do the grading and even track the student work. So we're going to put that inside of this really elegant framework for you. Yeah. And students still do the work where they work, right? On their blogs, in their websites, on Google Docs, whatever it might be, the tools that they prefer. But your job as a teacher, the feedback loop, will facilitate that and make it easy. So, and that was something that I really appreciated.
So I think you've hinted at my next question already, but so what do you attribute the relatively rapid rise in the adoption within higher ed that doesn't change very often, things very often?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot, especially as the company has matured and you know, my position in the company is to make sure that we fulfill our promises while keeping the business healthy. And I think as much of it really was sort of a product of the time as it was the product itself. But I think the one thing that we have going for us now is just really great people in the company. You know, I think because we started with some pretty strong values, we were not afraid to talk about those values, and those values affected every single hire that we've made. The people in the company, man, they're fantastic. And it's the people and the experience that institutions and users have with those people that I think will make us successful in the future.
I've already mentioned working with Hillary, and you're so correct as far as the people that I've interacted with, beyond just professionalism, just really listening to what I'm trying to do and trying to figure out a way to make that happen. And it's like you said, there's some things that Hillary just said, nope, we don't do that. You're not trying to be all things for all people. And especially when you're talking, I'm working with her from a perspective of a MOOC, and you've got a lot of people, thousands of people. And so it's just been really a great experience to be able to pick up the phone or send an email and actually have a real human being that is going to give a thoughtful response to the question rather than pointing me to some support page or something like that. So it's more getting into the nuts and bolts. I also want to pick up on something you mentioned, the openness side of things in the code, and that and now because I've been talking for 11 hours, my words are escaping me, but what do you call the your annual InstructureCon? Is that what it is?
Yeah, we have an annual users conference called InstructureCon. Again, we set out to make that a very different kind of event, not only the kind of event that focused on the stories of people who are using the software, people who are figuring out new ways to use other software in context of our software, but have a lot of fun, generate energy, get the spirit that people have inside of them expressed and out in the open. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And so this year, I believe if I heard correctly, the theme was open, right? And it was at the year of open, is that if I remember correctly? So can you kind of touch on some of the themes that came up during the conference and how that would relate to Canvas and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So Canvas launched in January 2011, and that was about the same time that we open sourced the code. And so, it's been about 5 years, and we decided to spend a good amount of our time this year thinking about whether or not the hypothesis, or I guess the bet that we laid, that openness would enable innovation and help us, give more power to more people. Was that bet actually paying off? And so we looked at it in three different veins. The open platform, open content, and open education. And so we've published some materials that kind of reflect upon that. And we talked about it at the users conference as well. And that was the main theme of my talk there, where we kind of looked at each of those different elements of openness and showed some examples from the community of how people were making a difference through openness, through those three different avenues, and some pretty cool stories, and I think it sets us up really well to continue to invest in openness, continue to fight for it, because it's not something that people necessarily put at the top of their list when they want things fixed in a learning management system, but it's core to who we are, and I think it's critical for the future.
Yeah, and I'm not here to give you a free sales pitch or anything, but I do want to make sure people are aware of the free things and the way that they can access open resources as well as free resources. And so, as you mentioned, there's the from the resource side of the house, the Canvas Commons, right, where folks can share. So we'll kind of go through them maybe one at a time, and maybe you could give a little overview of what Canvas Commons is all about.
Yeah, sure. So, we open sourced the Canvas code, which means anybody can download it and run it. We think most people will want us to run it for them, and that's how we make money. And so that's like an easy way to be open. The open platform capabilities I talked about before, it's an open API, so developers can, get information out of Canvas and put it back in and develop their own tools that plug in really nicely. But then you get to stuff like open content. And open content or open educational resources, I mean, this isn't a new idea. This has been around for a long time, and I've been involved in the open content movement for a number of years. And there are some fantastic platforms and libraries of OER out there, like OER Commons. But the challenge that we were trying to solve with Canvas, within Canvas, is really the challenge that I saw as I had worked with faculty over the years. Folks who know about OER and are excited about OER know how to find and use OER in their courses, right? They're determined enough to figure it out on their own. But for everybody else, they don't have any idea what it is. They don't know where to go to get it. And if they did know where to go, they would probably have a hard time getting that into their courses. So what we did with Commons is we created this platform that's kind of separate from Canvas, but so tightly integrated that anybody who uses Canvas for their courses is going to notice it right away and say, oh, what's that? And it's sort of a library of OER where you can browse through resources, everything from files to entire courses or modules, and with just a couple of clicks, bring those things into your course and try them out, and maybe change them inside of your course and share them back to Commons. So the reuse and remix and sharing is just part of the whole experience of using Canvas. And that was our goal, is just to kind of make the practice of reusing and remixing and sharing OER something that's a little more natural to day-to-day teachers.
I think that's a really good point. It took me a while to realize that. At first I was thinking, and we CC license, Creative Commons license our MOOC, so anybody can use it. Mm-hmm. And so I had always thought of Canvas Commons as being a place where you'd put your entire course. But I don't know why I didn't make the connection. It can be as small as like an assignment or something, something a lot.
Yeah.
And we actually ended up downloading and sending the file this week, but it's also kind of a handy way if you're sharing those materials rather than downloading, figuring out how you're going to physically share a large file. So it kind of has a hidden benefit. we can use your use you as a big Dropbox almost to move
files. Yeah, I mean, what people were asking for in the beginning was a way to share files. Mm-hmm. Text files or HTML files or whatever. And that's so boring. The IMS organization has a standard for packaging resources, educational resources, called a Common Cartridge. And so Canvas Commons, so confusing with all these commons, Canvas Commons only accepts content in Common Cartridge format. And that's how it shares it back to Canvas. So Canvas Commons actually has its own API. And so you can pull stuff out of Canvas Commons in Common Cartridge format and use that elsewhere.
Did not know that. That's something new I just learned.
So that's kind of a new thing. It's a little bit of a hidden feature, but it's kind of important for us from a technology standpoint to have those APIs in place because, again, those can be made available before any tool or user interface takes advantage of them, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And then, at least for me, it's parallel. It's probably not for everybody, but within our MOOC, we have the students have the ability to, well, not have the ability, everybody has the ability, but we show them how to get a Free for Teachers account, which then will also dovetail, and they can go in and get content within Canvas Commons. So would you want to just give a little overview on what the Free for Teachers is and
sure.
Again, free for anybody, right?
Yeah, free for anybody. And this was one of the things we launched when we launched Canvas, six years ago now almost. And it's just a free instance of Canvas. So Canvas is a cloud platform like Google. There's no version. It's just always the latest version. And Free for Teachers is the free version for individual teachers to set up courses and even run them there. It's kind of a natural place to go if you don't use Canvas at your institution. If you want to access some of those resources that are on Commons or create and share those resources as well.
Or host your own little class, right? If you have a face-to-face class and you want to have a small online component, that's a great way to test the waters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Eugene was asking...
There's a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
A couple of questions in the chat.
Go ahead,
Eugene asked, what's the most successful effort Jared's found when introducing faculty who do not understand the potential of OER? Yeah, I did used to run workshops directly for faculty on the advantages of OER. And for me, the best way in was to actually take them through the exercise of finding OER in the discipline in which they were working. And it didn't necessarily have to tie to a direct course, but introducing OER more as a workshop, a hands-on workshop, and less as a lecture, for me, seemed to be pretty effective. Because once they both saw what was out there and then, you know, kind of brought it into the environment that they had control over so that they could play with it, you know, they might not end up using it in their class, but that's, you know, that's a quick view of how you actually get started with this stuff. And to me, that's the way to have the conversation. I like the approach of saying, hey, you've got great stuff, you should share it with the world. But I found for the majority of instructors, you know, like all of us, we tend to think about what's in it for me first. And so if you show them great free resources that you can actually change, unlike the stuff that you get from the publisher, that was a good way to start those conversations, especially if they were able to actually play around with it in their course environment.
And Nicola, by the way, is in South Africa, and I believe it's like 2 a.m. there. So she is diehard.
Wow.
She bought into this whole concept.
You thought you were tired. Yeah.
Exactly. She bought into our concept of webcast-a-thon here. I believe she's saying that her question relates, can you track reuse? I think that's with Canvas Commons, I'm guessing, as far
as. Yeah. So Nicola, Canvas Commons tracks everything. But we haven't surfaced a lot of the data on reuse. But I have a research team, and we did a little bit of this investigation earlier this year to understand how resources were being reused. Are they being reused mostly within an institution or being shared between institutions? And I think our conclusion, and this is, you know, Commons is still pretty new, but I think our conclusion was that to date, most reuse of OER happens within an institution, but it, you know, there are a lot of single resources or entire courses that are getting reused dozens and dozens of times by, you know, up to, I think the highest count we saw was up to 115 different institutions. So the potential for reuse is amazing, just because the Canvas community is growing. But we'll figure out a way to surface the reuse information eventually. I don't know when.
If you're okay with it, I'd kind of like to talk about you and your role and like the things that now we'll talk about you and your passions. And in your bio, you mentioned the research aspect and some of the practice things you're interested in. So what are some of your passion projects that you're looking forward to working on, or that some stuff you're working on right now that we may see down the road?
Yeah, so always near the top of my list is just how can we simplify the user experience of Canvas. It's an ongoing challenge. It's more of a path than a destination. But how can we continue to simplify that experience so that it gets out of the way? You know, I mean, when you think about cognitive psychology and the idea that we have only so much available space in our working memory or our, to process what's going on in front of us, any interaction that we have with software is going to take up some of that. And that for a teacher means less time and energy that they spend on the stuff that really matters, whether that's creating resources or more often interacting with the student. And so, you know, that's a continual challenge for me, and that's never going to leave my top 10 list. But from there, it's a question of, okay, now how do we encourage teachers and students to do more of what matters? And that's kind of a tough question, because what does matter in any kind of learning experience? Every teacher is probably going to have a different answer for that. But I think one thing we tend to all agree on is that feedback loop, that continuous feedback loop between teacher and student and teacher. That's so critical. And yet it's also so time consuming. So, you know, if we can find ways to facilitate that, to encourage more of that kind of interaction around the work that students are doing, then we'll be winning in terms of the user experience and what Canvas sort of encourages folks to do. So that's number one, you know, the user experience. Number two for me right now is thinking about how outcomes can play more of a role in teachers' course design. And so outcomes, objectives, you know, whatever you want to call it, not in the sometimes pejorative instructional design world of outcomes and objectives, where, you know, a faculty member might feel like outcomes are oppressive or objectives are oppressive because they have it constrains them. But really, in a way of, you know, outcomes are just the articulation of where you want students to be at the end of the learning experience. They represent your vision for student success. And so, you know, we're thinking about how can we make that a little bit more, I don't know if I want to say appealing, but a little more useful to more teachers, so that they get better at expressing that, for lack of a better term, vision for their students at the beginning of the course, throughout all of their learning activities, and that the evidence that students provide is directly tied to that vision of the outcomes. So that's something we're kind of working on right now. And I think that's sort of a necessary work for us before we get back into learning analytics. And this is something where we've done some work in the past, and last year we added a new feature called Canvas Data, which gives administrators access to a pretty complete data set that's optimized for analysis. But I think next year we're going to spend a fair amount of time kind of rethinking analytics as much from a student perspective as from the teacher perspective. That is to say, what are the kinds of information that students would actually use to change how they go about learning? Whether that's their study habits or the time that they commit to their courses, or even just a sense of their performance relative to others. I don't know what the right answer is, but that's where we want to spend some time doing some deep thinking. What could Canvas do potentially to make the things that are invisible to students more visible so that they can make better choices based upon it?
And I would be remiss if I didn't bring up a conversation you and I had. I think we almost forgot the conversation when we met the second time, or talked the second time, but it's probably like 3 or 4 years ago, I think now. And we were talking about ways that the Canvas, the LMS could be used outside of what we typically think, like a higher education, a university would purchase the rights or whatever it is to use Canvas. And we were talking at that time about adult basic education. So I'm going to circle back to some of the themes we've talked about today, and what a diverse and what heterogeneous group it is. It may be a basement of a library. It may be at a faith-based center where you have open entry and students coming in and out. So I've given you softballs up to this point, so now I'm going to hit you with the hard ones. But, you know, how can that work? You know, some thoughts on how people can access and use Canvas for maybe many users, but not in a traditional manner where you have a semester long course and you know you're going to have 60 students, and it's an easy way for Canvas as well as the institution to know how to charge for that, you know, purchasing that product.
Yeah.
How does that, any thoughts on that? Continuing a conversation you had years ago on this idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think for kind of a broad use of Canvas, honestly, that's what we set up Free for Teachers to be. If you've got, you know, some pretty specific use cases and you just need an LMS, you just need a place to post files or to, you know, connect people together. You know, that's what Free for Teachers is for. Getting beyond that, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, we want Canvas to be flexible enough to address as many different instructional approaches and instructional goals as possible, but we're not going to expand our kind of target markets to include everything and everybody.
I
don't know. Ask me more about that if that's not a good answer.
No. No, we talked about this a long time ago because our ultimate idea was with creating these the OER, the instruction instructors are able to use for adult basic education, is it would reside somewhere. And then we don't know who it might be that would just decide, okay, I'm going to work with this particular student and we're going to access this pot of resources. And it may only be three modules out of the 75 that are available. And that's where I think our original conversation came in. And I hate to use the example, but I'm going to use the example, like the Khan Academy in a way, where it's somebody may come in, use something, and leave. And what I know, it just gets difficult when you're thinking about, well, how would you charge?
I see what you're saying. So in one possible future scenario, Commons could be its own website and not just make it possible for educators to find and reuse those resources, but perhaps to allow for learners to interact with those resources on the fly. That's not something we do today. It's an interesting idea we've thought about in the past for sure.
Yeah,
it would be somewhere between like what Canvas Network is today and what Commons is today.
Yeah, and we had a conversation with Lisa Petrides from OER Commons earlier, this whole idea of the teacher-facing versus the learner-facing. And as you're saying, Canvas Commons is great for the teacher-facing, the instructional designer-facing. It's just a different, but that's not unusual. Almost everything we talk about in adult basic education is just a different, it's a different animal than what's.
But it certainly does. I mean, that question, represents one of the decisions that we have to face as a business and, as a product team, which I'm a part of. And that's, who do you design your software for? And, we've always leaned toward being student-centered and toward incorporating features into Canvas that will benefit students. But that's a hard thing to continue to do when the dominant voice is appropriately the instructor, the one who does the design. And so if, as a business, our audience was more of the learner writ large, right, around the world, then that idea, I think, would be perfectly suited. As it is, we love the idea. It's then a question of how do we prioritize that versus our number one stakeholder, at this point in time, which is the instructor.
Right. Yeah. So I just keep asking. Every time I talk to you, I somehow.
It's a great question.
I don't know. But like you said, the Free for Teachers really has a lot of the people who are interested in it within our MOOC. That's exactly what they're going to do. Just take it as an individual back to their little tiny classroom and figure out a way to have more of a blended approach.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up at the end. So here's our big question we've been asking everybody. Well, actually, it's kind of a two-part question. One, who has been your inspiration in you as far as when you're thinking of getting into education and this whole all the stuff we've been talking about today? And then also the part B of the question is then, what do you want to be your legacy? So what impact will you make?
Cool. Wow. Okay. That first question. It would be so easy for me to talk about a guy that has continued to inspire me over the years, who I'm sure other people have mentioned as well, David Wiley. But let me talk about a friend and a mentor of mine who just passed away this year. Some folks may know him. His name is John Crouch. He worked with me at Utah Valley University. Him and I were a really great combination because I would be more interested in the academic side while he would be more interested in the technology side. But we kind of came together around this idea that in order to move things forward, you just had to make it work. You had to hack things together, and then you had to open up and share those things. And, kind of in the beginning, we would go to a lot of conferences and take every opportunity that we had to talk about the stuff that we were doing, whether it was fully baked or not, to get some ideas and conversations going. And so John was just so good at not only coming up with quick and dirty solutions for real problems that teachers had with technology, but also about kind of boldly sharing those and listening to new ideas and building this sort of perpetual motion machine of ideas and energy and technology solutions. So yeah, John Kruch, one of my ed tech heroes for sure.
That sounds like a great person. I'm sorry for your loss. Yeah, a lot of people today have mentioned just the idea in general of passion. It sounds like, you know, he inspired you from his passion.
Absolutely. And honestly, just from making it work, getting something going, you know, not talking about grand ideas, but rolling up your sleeves and hacking something together and putting it out there, you know, prototypes for the win. So he was fantastic. In terms of my legacy, I don't think about that. I tend to dwell a little bit more in the here and now. And, you know, my goal is whoever I'm with in this moment, if I can help, I will try to help.
You know what? That is actually an awesome answer. It's a perfect answer. Be in the moment. It's been really interesting. And I wish I would have been doing a better job documenting these as I've asked this. That's kind of been our fall. You know, education impact has been our question. And I love this one. This is a brand new one that you'll live in the moment and be present. So that's cool. And I feel
that's
like you were.
I can't plan any further than 2 weeks ahead. I plan 2 weeks ahead. That's all.
And I feel you were. I felt the connection today. So you did. You made an impact. So, well, thank you so much, Sharon. And feel free if you want to stick around
right.
or whatever.
Thank
we're just.
You.
We're hanging around for another hour with we got Eugene and now Jason's cool. got his son here, I see too. So, but thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks, everybody.